the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. Our guests this week are all veterans of World War II, all Marines, all pilots, and all members of the original and later legendary Black Sheep Squadron. Led by ace pilot Greg Pappy Boyington, the squadron was formed in the summer of 1943 and was in action over a half dozen South Pacific islands. In less than 3 months, the Black Sheep pilots destroyed or damaged 273 Japanese aircraft, sank ships, destroyed ground facilities, and most remarkably produced 8 ace fighter pilots from only a single squadron. Retired Brigadier General Bruce Matheson was in that squadron, and he relates how it came to be known as the Black Sheep.
The Black Sheep name came from our first combat tour, and we had a squadron which was comprised almost entirely of college students. And these college students had come from colleges all over the country. These were the days before television, and we didn't have any radio out there, no entertainment. So our entertainment was comprised of singing, which sounds like a rather ancient thing to do, but we sang. And fortunately, we had several good voices in the group, and we sang four-part harmony. And one of the songs that one of the Ivy Leaguers brought along was the Black Sheep song, or the Whiffenpoo song, which is the Yale drinking song. And we dearly loved that song, and we managed to sing it frequently and always the very last one in our repertoire. So when it came time to name the squadron, figuring we should have a name, it was suggested that the name be Boyington's Bastards, because the squadron was formed in a kind of a bastardly fashion. We had no ground echelon. We had no airplanes. The press people at the time said, no, in case you do anything noteworthy, we can't hardly go back. In those days when you couldn't use four-letter words and allude to you as Boyington's Bastards, so you're going to have to do better than that. So somebody said, why don't we make it the Black Sheep? And we allowed us how that was a pretty good idea. So we decided we were the Black Sheep and referred to ourselves that way, as did the press. When we went to Sydney on our first R&R, rest and recuperation visit in November of 1943, our squadron intelligence officer had patches made up, unknown to us, which some of our people had designed. And the patches featured a little black humpback sheep, the words VMF 214, a corsair on the top, but across diagonally it had the bar sinister, which represents bastardry. And so we made our point, but we didn't make it orally. We made it through our patch, and we've carried this bastard patch ever since. And the bastard patch is still proudly worn by 214's pilots, who today are Yuma, Arizona, and I believe they've also made a deployment to Iraq.
Well, that's a great history, but as a Harvard man, I have to say I might have preferred Boyington's Bastards in the first place.
I would imagine you would. I would imagine you would.
How did you get involved in it?
In the squadron. Yeah. I came into the squadron, like pretty much everybody else, as one of a large replacement pool. And it really was comprised of two sorts of folks. Folks like us, brand new second lieutenants, literally just off the boat, who had never seen combat, and a group of people who had one or more combat tours behind them and were looking to fly a third tour. The requirement out there was 3 combat tours and then you went home. So we were in this replacement pool, which in the past was used to feed pilots into squadrons as the need arose. Either as people got sick, got shot down, killed, wounded, whatever. The time we arrived out there, there was a sort of a lull in the war, and we didn't need very many replacements. So this pool built up until gradually we had probably 28 or 30 people out there. the same time, the war looked to be gaining momentum in that they intended to invade Bougainville. So the call went out for what can we do to strengthen our forces. And the obvious solution to the generals in charge was, why don't we do something with these replacement pilots? Rather than dribble them out one at a time, maybe we can form them into a squadron. And this was done. So what we did was we took the squadron number 214 from a squadron which at the time was on R&R in Sydney, Australia, took the number, adopted the number, stole the number, really, as I found out after the war. Many people were very bitter about that. Boyington was placed in charge as the commander, and we went into combat as VMF 214, nicknamed Black Sheep. Still bastards, because we had no ground echelon. We had no ground troops of our own, because there weren't any for us. So we were forced during our two combat tours to kind of prevail on whoever was around to help us with such things as refueling, rearming, repair, this sort of thing. So we went through our entire two tours as a kind of a bastard outfit.
Where were you permanently based? I mean, you had to have a place to park your planes.
We were permanently based in some of the forward airstrips. For instance, when we started out in combat, we started at a little island called the Russells, which is north of Guadalcanal. We flew strikes from there up north into the Solomons. Then when Munda was captured by the Marines, they completed the airfield which the Japs had started and made it usable, and we flew from Munda for the balance of our first six-week tour. By the time we came back from our first R&R in Sydney, we came back to the New Hebrides to reform and retrain, absorb new pilots for our replacements for the people we'd lost. They made the squadron a little bit bigger. The next time we went up in our permanent base, you might call it, for the 6 weeks, was a place called Villa Lovella, which was in the Northern Solomons. We flew from there. And at this point, we were fighting against the Japanese in Rabaul. And at that time, the thought was that Rabaul probably would have to be invaded as we had invaded the other islands in the Solomons. But we were successful enough, when I say we, I mean the entire air effort, which is Marine Corps, Navy, Army Air Corps, we were successful enough to completely rid the area of Japanese planes. When we left after our second tour, there were almost no Japanese airplanes available. They had either shot down or they'd been evacuated. So the powers that be decided, we don't have to invade Rabaul, we'll just bypass it. And they did that. And they literally left about 50,000 Japanese in the Rabaul area to more or less wither on the vine. Some survived, most didn't.
I don't mean this to be a naive question, but I'm a former Navy officer myself, one time, a long time ago, but given the nature of this squadron and the fact that it really had no ground echelon, did you have comparatively more autonomy to act on your own? Is Boynton capable of calling up assignments?
No. Boynton was a major, which in those days was a pretty high-ranking officer for Marines. But Boynton was relatively firmly under control of the general who was Commair Salas, which is Commander Aircraft Solomon Islands.
Okay.
And he took his directions from Commair Salas. Various general officers, General Mulcahy was one that I remembered, who was a personal friend of Boynton's. Boynton was able to prevail upon General Mulcahy to get us to go on fighter sweeps, because before that time, our pure mission was to escort bombers, both Navy and Marine bombers, and our Air Corps bombers, B-24s, B-25s. He said, let's do fighter sweeps, and maybe we can go up to places like Rabaul and catch the fighters before they come down to do harm. And so we began fighter sweeps. I don't think that Boynton invented fighter sweeps, because I'm pretty sure that the fighter sweep per se was a product of the Battle of Britain. And I think both the German, the Luftwaffe, and the RAF had fighter sweeps where they sent huge gaggles of fighters up against each other. But in the Pacific, we didn't have fighter sweeps. It was all the fighters did all escort work and air defense. For instance, most of the victories at Guadalcanal were air defense victories. It was people who were there to defend the Guadalcanal complex. And they would take off and they would fight, and the Japanese were in the offensive mode. And our Marine and Navy fighters on the strip there would take off to defend the strip. And I don't want to take anything away from those people like Marion Carl and Joe Foss and John L. Smith, Medal of Honor winners. But they had the comfort of knowing they were fighting right above their own home field, so that if they got shot down, made a water landing, or bailed up, fairly good chance that they'd be brought back again. When we got involved, particularly in our second tour, we were flying about 200 miles across open water to a Japanese bastion, which is what Rabaul was, and you took your chances there. And we've often discussed when we've gotten together about the 12 people we lost, which is a quarter of our squadron, and we've often said, I wonder how many of these guys really were shot down vis-a-vis how many of them got lost and couldn't find their way back, because we had zero navigational aids. We had no radar, no LORAN, no SHORAN, no TACAN, none of the things which are common. No GPS, of course. So it was purely magnetic headings on the compass. And you picked a course, and if your compass was working right, you got back to your little island. But as I say, we often wonder how many of our contemporaries and buddies and squadron mates might not have been shot down, but were lost on the way home.
So what Boeington really did was turn the squadron into a proactive instead of a reactive mode.
Right. Precisely. Precisely. And it was not just the squadron, because he was able to enlist the general support. And at times we would have the early fighter sweeps, as many as 60 or 80 fighter aircraft on our side. And Boeington soon decided that this was far too big an outfit, this far, far too big to control. So the later fighter sweeps got down to be around maybe 24 planes. And they were usually comprised of two or three different squadrons. They would each contribute part of the planes. So that, for instance, on Boeington's last flight, which I happened to wind up flying, I think we had pilots and fighters there from three Marine squadrons and a couple of Navy squadrons. So it was a pretty big mixture.
Matheson would go on to fly missions in Korea and command Marine Air Group 36 in Vietnam. When we return, the story of Black Sheep Lieutenant Colonel Tom Emery.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Vietnam area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with four members of the original and famed Marine Corps Black Sheep Squadron. Tom Emmerich was one of those pilots.
I was in a pool over in the South Pacific, and Boeington had been down in Guadalcanal and had fallen and broken a leg and was down away from Guadalcanal and wherever he recovered. And then he came back, and he was a major of the right rank for a CO and had the combat experience. I went over on a ship called the USS Rochambeau with about 50 or 60 officers and about 4,500 troops hanging on the outside of the decks of a little French ship that captured in the south during or after the war started. So then I got sent over to there, and suddenly they had more pilots and sitting around. Then Boeington had broken his leg, and he's recovered. And so now they have some of us that are Marines that are unassigned, and a squadron CO with combat experience that has no job. And they put us together and formed a 214, and I got assigned to that squadron.
How did you come to be out there in the first place? Where did you get your flight training, and where did you join the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I had my flight training in Jacksonville. Well, I started out in Kansas City,
and was there 4 months in color elimination base. At that particular time, I had a private license. I was an ace. I had about 35 hours, you know. How you think when you got that time at that early in the stage, you figure 35 hours, you know it all. And so then I went to Jacksonville and then got time for graduation toward the in December. And they put out a list and said, do you want to belong with you? The Marine Corps needs a few good people. A typical Marine Corps publicity. And if you're interested, put your name down on this list. Then somebody in that group said, the Marines are a good deal because the advancement in rank is faster than it is in the Navy. So that sounded very encouraging. So I signed my name up to that, and when we got commissioned in Jacksonville, I was commissioned as second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. And then that's how I got out there and in a pool, and then went from there out to the replacement and got signed out to Guadalcanal as a replacement pilot.
Right. And how many missions did you end up flying?
68.
And they were all in the Rabaul, South Pacific area, or did the squadron move anywhere else?
By that time, I was signed up to Green Island. On the third tour, I was up to Green Island. But by that time, there wasn't any Japanese airplanes left up in Rabaul. We had destroyed them all. And so on a third, we had to make 3 tours. So on the third tour, we're up on Green Island, which I think, if I remember correctly, was about 80 miles north of Rabaul, where the Japanese had 6 airfields. And, of course, they shot down all the Japanese airplanes, and there wasn't any way for the, with all the Navy ships we had out in the Pacific, there was no way they could bring down replacement airplanes to the Japanese in Rabaul. So then no enemy airplane to, you know, shoot down. So then we got assigned to Green Island, which was about 80 miles away. And the Japanese had been there beforehand, but left and said, you can have it because there's no water there. But, of course, Americans with all our supply ships and stuff, I supplied the water by ships there. It's true, there wasn't any water wells there. And so then we, as I say, there wasn't any Japanese airplanes left, so we just kind of tooled around and flew around over to about 80 miles, I think, over to Rabaul. And anything that moved, if we saw a guy down on the ground, we made a strafing run, tried to strafe him, you know. And then if he got too close to, I remember one day, I got a little brave, and I got closer to the shore flying around the island, the Japanese island. Next thing you know, here comes some burst of anti-aircraft off about 200 or 300 yards, and that kind of changed my mind about getting too close to the shore. And so there wasn't any airplanes to shoot down, so we just spent our third tour in Green Island and then came back to the States.
That was Tom Emmerich, a member of the original Marine Air Squadron known as the Black Sheep. After these messages, we'll hear the stories of 2 other pilots in that legendary squadron. This is Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to 2 organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of the Khan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Führer's face.
That's the ammunition and we'll hold.
We cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with four members of the original Marine Corps Air Squadron known as the Black Sheep, and renowned for its exploits against the Japanese in the South Pacific during World War II. One of those pilots is retired Colonel Ed Harper.
I was one of many people that were in college when Pearl Harbor happened. And in my case, you lived with a little group in a dorm, and we spent the first 2 days after Pearl Harbor sitting in various people's rooms talking what the hell we were going to do. Of the six of us, three left school and went off and signed up right then. Two were seniors in ROTC, and if they waited till next June, they'd get commissioned in the Army and the Marine Corps. And I was the guy, one guy that didn't do anything immediately because I thought there'd be something after the war, and I was having a tough time staying in school financially, and I didn't want to waste a semester. And so I went to Spokane and signed up in the Navy for flight training over the Christmas holidays before the end of that second semester that I had to complete. And the Navy is very comfortable with it. They said they wouldn't call me up until February. And that's how I got headed into the Navy. And as you were completing flight training, which included Seattle and Jacksonville, Florida, one day, a couple of Marine captains came by and started talking to us about joining the Marine Corps, meaning that we had an option. I debated it for a little while because I liked the Navy uniform better than the Marine uniform. But if you wanted to go to war, when that's what I signed up for, you almost had to join the Marine Corps because most of the Navy's carriers were sunk, and I was trained as a carrier pilot. So after some agony with myself, I said, if the only reason I'm not going into the Marine Corps is the goddamn uniform, I better not use that as a basis. So I ended up volunteering for the Marine Corps. And in those days, the Navy and the Marine Corps had a deal on who got to go into the Marine Corps. If more people volunteered for the Marine Corps than they were going to take, they got to select a bit. And if it was the other way around, the Navy got to select a bit. And in my group, twice as many kids asked for the Marine Corps as were selected. So I've always been able to say I was one of the few. Not necessarily true, but you had a good talking point.
He still is a good talking point for the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
One of the few. Matter of fact, so after you decided to sign on with the Marine Corps, I assume you were sent to further training, and where is your transition from the World War II period to Korea and the Black Sheep?
Well, following a commission in the Marine Corps, they sent us to Chicago, and we had to check out on a carrier before they deploy us, and then immediately they sent us to San Diego, put us on a ship, and sent us to the South Pacific. Quite a few of my friends that were in flight training with me were in the same group, and we all went out together. And that ended us at Espirito Santos in a pilot pool. Out of the pilot pool, 214 was born, and we went on from there to have a very interesting period of time in the Black Sheep.
In what way? What do you remember most about the interesting time?
Well, I guess the thing that made the biggest impression on you was that I got shot up a lot and ended up with a couple of Purple Hearts, and one of them put me in the hospital for 6 months. And while the other kids got to, that was toward the end of our last tour, the other buddies got to go home, and I got to go to a hospital for 6 months. Now, you never forget that.
What about some of the missions themselves?
Well, I had only had one mission I ever flew with Boeington, and that was over a ball on a big fighter sweep. We maybe had 75 or 80 friendly planes behind us. He was leading this major sweep. And as we approached Rabaul at fairly high altitude, he throttled back and started slowing down. I was his wingman, and so I kept looking over my shoulder to see who's behind me. And initially, I had a whole maze of airplanes. Then there were fewer, and then there were fewer. And pretty soon, I looked back, and there's nobody there but us. And he was chugging along. No speed at all. I don't know what the hell he was doing. I found out after we got home, and I asked Skipper, what in the world were you thinking about? And he said, I'm looking for somebody to do something stupid. As we let down, Zeros were coming up, climbing up to our altitude and standing on their tail and shooting at us and then falling off. And pretty soon I saw one guy ahead of us making a high side on us. It was getting pretty serious just to sit there and chug. I turned into him, made a head on, turned back, never saw Boeington again. I don't know what the hell, where he went. At my altitude, I saw three or four Zeros. Made a pass at them. One Zero pulled up across in front of me hard, and I got lucky. I threw a lot of lead on him and gave him a squirt, and I hit his wing. You could see the explosive shells popping in his wing. And he made the one fatal mistake you can't make. He panicked, tried to dive away. When he dove away, he was at high speeds, higher speeds, the Zero couldn't outmaneuver. At low speeds, they could run circles around you. At high speeds, they couldn't. And so I ended up getting the only confirmed plane of the whole that I got in the whole war. Lots of chatter about probables and shooting things up, but it was a judgment call on your part whether you claimed an airplane or not. Until I had one burning and crashing in the ocean, I didn't call him, didn't claim it, and so I wasn't much of a wartime hero. I could say I got several probables that I shot at and hit, but depending on how ambitious you are and how liberal you are with the truth, with a little more of that, I perhaps could have been an ace.
One of Ed Harper's comrades on those fighter sweeps over the South Pacific was now retired Lieutenant Colonel Jim Hill.
I started my elimination training in the New Orleans Naval Air Station. They called it E-Base, and that's E stood for elimination, and a lot of us were eliminated. That was our primary training, and we flew the N3N Stearman. That's with the open cockpit. And that was really flying. From there, I went to Pensacola to advanced training and flew the SNJ. Now, the SNJ was a sleek-looking airplane. I thought it was a fighter plane at first, but it was an advanced trainer. And from there, I went on to Jacksonville, and I flew the F-4F Wildcat. Now, that was a fighter plane at that time. And it was being used in Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands. Well, during my training, we were checking out on the night landings in an SNJ at Pensacola. And I'd gone around for about three or four times. And I came in... And they shot this red flare in front of me. That's mandatory. Do not land. Go around again. I gave it full throttle and eased out of the traffic circle. And bang! The fella behind me had lost his interval. And he went right into me. Knocked me out. Now, they tell me my plane I had given it full throttle. It went up into a half loop, stalled out, and crashed, burst into flames. I was unconscious the minute he hit me. Woke up in the hospital, found out what happened, and I remember after about 3 days, I was able to go to the bathroom. I looked in the mirror, and I said, "Who the hell is that?" My head was swollen. I had two of the blackest eyes you have ever seen. My jaw had been crushed and was out of position. But I recovered from that, and I was sent into a group of pilots with these fellows on the same ship. I had individual orders. Because of this accident, I was not with my class. I was delayed a full month. So I ended up on the ship, went out to the New Hebrides Islands, where we all ended up in a pool of pilots. There were 28 of us. And Pappy Boeington was there at the time, and he always wanted to be CEO of his own squadron. Now, he had been with the Flying Tigers, but he's just one of the boys, and he didn't get along with anybody. Nobody liked Pappy Boeington in the Flying Tigers. But anyway, Pappy went to the commanding officer out there where we were, the pool pilots, and he said, "We got 28 fellas out here. Man, I'd like to take them over and be a CO." Well, General Green at the time of those islands, he said, "Boy, you're talking to me at just the right time," because he had just talked to Admiral Halsey, who was in charge of the whole Marine and Navy forces out there, and he said, "Our pilots are getting shot up so badly, we need another Marine fighter squadron. So you've got it." And that's the way we were formed. And the way we got the name of Black Sheep is the way we were formed. We never trained in the States together like all other squadrons did. We got out in the combat area individually, and that's the way Pappy Boeington took us over. And because of that, the unique things, the way we were formed, got together, we came up with that Black Sheep name.
What do you remember about Boeington as a man? You say he was not liked at all in Chenault's Flying Tiger group, but how was he thought of by the men in the Black Sheep Squadron?
To us, Pappy Boeington was the best damn commanding officer of a Marine fighter squadron during combat, during a wartime. He was the best commanding officer you could have because he inspired you to do what he would do, and he would do anything out there. He once got us together and he said, "Fellas, I won't ask you to do anything I wouldn't do." But when he got in the air, man, he did things that I didn't think were possible.
And that drove the rest of you to a higher level?
Oh, yeah. He was an inspiration. Mm-hmm. Gave us a lot of courage, a lot of gung-ho.
Finally, when you look back on your time in the service during the war, what are your thoughts and impressions about that today?
Well, I always wanted to get in the Marines, and I had a hard time. I went through as a Navy cadet, you know, and when we had finished our training and ready to get our wings, You designated whether you wanted to stay in the Navy or go Marine Corps. And I always wanted to go in the Marine Corps, but you had to go through as a Navy cadet. So they interviewed us. There were 15 of us pilots that wanted to go Marines rather than Navy. And they interviewed us. There were two Marine pilots and two Navy pilots interviewed us. And they were only going to take three Marines. Well, we were sitting there on the bench, and I saw two fellas during the course of the interviews came out. They said, "Hey, I got that in the Marines." And I thought, "My God, there's only one spot left." And they called my name to be interviewed. So I got up there, and they said, "Why do you want to be a Marine?" I said, "Listen, I always wanted to be a Marine, and if I can't be a Marine, I want out of here. And boy, these Marine pilots took me.
You've been listening to the stories of four Marine Corps pilots, all members of the original Black Sheep Squadron of World War II legend. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.